are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, February 3rd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, the State Department have come out with their environmental impact study on the Keystone XL pipeline. Talking to us about reaction to that study and planned actions to fight the approval of the Keystone XL pipeline will be the senior campaign manager for Credo, Elijah Zarlin, will be joining us later in the program. Also on the program today, drip, 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 drop, drop, drop. More shoes falling on Chris Christie. I am beginning to bathe in the somewhat ambivalent tears of Joe Scarborough. Also on the program today, please don't fire me for saying that it appears that some conservatives took the real exception with the idea that someone would sing, what is it, God Bless America or America the Beautiful?
The Beautiful, yes.
In some language not English. And not American English, I think, too, is more to the point. I don't want to hear those British guys, or gals, for that matter, singing America the Beautiful. They don't really mean it. Also on the program, that Pew poll from last week showing that many feel they have completely dropped out of the middle class is reflected in what corporations know. Don't get into the business of selling to the middle class. Nobody's home. More on where we are on immigration. And Peter Schiff, the guy that that The Daily Show had on to talk about the minimum wage, strikes back with a letter basically admitting he had no idea what he was talking about, but hopefully expanding his subscriber base. I don't know. He's an entrepreneur, so he's much better at hopping on those things. And we got to get on the email thing. Yes, he's an entrepreneur, so he's far more sophisticated in coming out with that email when he is attacked. But speaking of attacked, folks, on Friday afternoon after this program, there was just a ton of new developments in the Chris Christie story. Now, in the backdrop of this story is Chris Christie's political future. In the forefront is really Chris Christie's legal future, really, I should say.
Penal future.
Penal future is actually the word I was looking for. Indeed. So we will cover all of those. It's been fascinating. We're starting to see just a little bit of pushback from the most narrow of quarters in the political party in support of Chris Christie, but it is still sort of those dead enders, guys like Rudy Giuliani, who I don't even know if you call him a political figure anymore. He's just one of those guys who, you know, what has he got to lose if he supports another criminal? Bernie Kerik had basically done the damage for him. I mean, so he doesn't have much to lose. And then I think everybody else is probably like Dinesh D'Souza. Joe Scarborough is still attempting, but we will get into all of that. I think Bobby Jindal is also coming out in support of Chris Christie to a certain extent. But again, what does Bobby Jindal have to lose? His aspirations have been DOA since the moment he walked out like Mr. Rogers, attempting to give a State of the Union rebuttal. So on Friday, the big story was the New York Times came out with a piece saying that David Wildstein, this is the guy who was appointed to the Port Authority in a new position created by Chris Christie specifically for David Wildstein, a former blogger, New Jersey blogger at New Jersey Politicker. I think he went under the Wally somebody. I can't remember. Wally Edge. And seemingly, I guess he had managed a website that it had employed a couple of reporters. He didn't seem to have much other experience that would qualify him for this made-up job at the Port Authority. He was to be Chris Christie's eyes and ears at the Port Authority. And you'll recall that Chris Christie gave a 2-hour press conference back, I think it was in December now, when it became clear that there was other reasons for shutting down the lanes from Fort Lee onto the George Washington Bridge than the made-up reasons after the fact of it being a traffic study. Chris Christie at the time claimed, "I didn't hear about any of this until I saw the press reports about the lane closures." So the New York Times reported that a letter sent by David Wildstein's attorney, Alan L. Zegas, to the general counsel of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, said that David Wildstein is claiming that, in fact, the governor did know about the lane closures before hearing press accounts. In fact, he knew about them while they were going on. That doesn't tell us a lot, but it certainly tells us that Chris Christie was lying at that press conference. And that raises a whole nother host of questions, like, why? So here is that letter that was written. Some people say that the New York Times story blew this story out of proportion. It remains to be seen, but there's many things that we can glean from this. The letter is sent to the head of the Port Authority seeking the Port Authority to pay for Wildstein's legal representation in connection with the legislative proceedings that are taking place in the New Jersey State Assembly and Senate. Who knows what kind of legal costs he has for the Department of Justice proceedings, but this is just in regard to those Senate hearings, to those Assembly and Senate hearings. They also seek to indemnify David Wildstein for any civil lawsuits that are instituted against the Port Authority where Mr. Wildstein is named in the proceedings. They go on to explain that, look, you've done this for some other people from the Port Authority, including that guy Baroni, who also had to resign. And then they get into sort of other issues that ostensibly set up a conflict between the governor's administration and the Port Authority, which would ostensibly lead to the need for Wildstein to have protection on behalf or from the Port Authority. There have been reports that certain commissioners of the Port Authority have been connected directly or indirectly to land deals involving the Port Authority. that Port Authority funds were allocated to projects connected to persons who supported the administration of Governor Chris Christie or whose political support he sought, with some of the projects having no relationship to the business of the Port Authority, and that the Port Authority funds were held back from those who refused to support the governor. It has come to light that a person within the Christie administration communicated the Christie's administration's order that certain lanes on the George Washington Bridge were to be closed. So now those two paragraphs, there's just that one paragraph saying, hey, there are stories out there about Port Authority funds, and we will get to those stories in a moment because there's a couple of new ones, being diverted to projects that seem to have no association with the Port Authority, but just have to do with Governor Christie's relationship with them, as if they were saying, hey, there's been stories out there that the Port Authority has been used as a slush fund. We just wanted to include that in this paragraph for no seeming reason. The letter goes on to say, evidence exists, as well trying Mr. Christie, as well, excuse me, evidence exists tying Mr. Christie to having knowledge of the lane closures during the period when the lanes were closed, contrary to what the governor stated publicly in a two-hour press conference he gave immediately before Mr. Wildstein was scheduled to appear before the Transportation Committee. Now, if you had watched Morning Joe this morning, Joe Scarborough was saying, what's new about this? Well, what's new about this is that Wildstein is claiming to have evidence that shows, at a minimum, the governor lied during his press conference. Now, it's not a crime to lie during your press conference, but it does basically say, hey, there's at least enough here, to the extent that any of you had any dreams of him coming back in 2016, for that to go away. Mr. Wildstein contests the accuracy of various statements that the governor made about him, and he can prove the inaccuracy of some. So let's just parse that. Wildstein says that some of the statements about him were inaccurate. Now, maybe that's he's a jerk, he's a moron, he's an idiot, I don't know him, he was a loser in high school, he wasn't the jock I was. Maybe those are the only statements that Wildstein contests, and I that maybe there are some, which is a smaller subset, we should say, that he can prove were inaccurate. So there may or may not be something there. The reason why that letter is so obtuse, I would imagine, is because, one, in the sweepstakes, to as far as the Justice Department probably in particular is concerned, who will be the one to get immunity? And perhaps the sweepstakes for the legislative hearings. Who will be the one to get immunity? Who's got the goods on the big fish, as it were? So there's enough there to both try and whet the appetite of the Department of Justice, but also to scare Chris Christie. But I also imagine it scares the other people who are in that I want to get immunity first sweepstakes. We don't know what's going on with the DOJ investigation, but we have no reason to believe they're wrapping it up. So Chris Christie's office responds to this letter in a memo sent from the governor's office. And in this memo, the administration portrays David Wildstein as a loose cannon who made moves that were not productive, and that he was tumultuous while working there. The memo listed five incidents as evidence to those assertions. And then it gets pretty funny. The first piece of evidence is that David Wildstein, who the governor barely knew in high school, apparently, as a 16-year-old kid, had sued over a school board election. No indication as to whether or not this... No indication as to whether or not this information came to light after Governor Christie gave him a newly minted job at the Port Authority. Also, that he had been, quote, publicly accused by his high school social studies teacher of deceptive behavior in high school. Third, that he had had a controversial tenure as mayor of Livingston, New Jersey. Fourth, that he had been an anonymous blogger. All of this stuff, to my knowledge, was known to the Christie administration when Chris Christie handpicked him to be in a new job at the Port Authority. And that he had a strange habit of registering web addresses for other people's names without telling them. So Chris Christie is really scraping the bottom of the bucket here to malign David Wildstein. And I think he's doing a good job of maligning the guy, but not necessarily undercutting any of his stories as to what happened, particularly in light of the fact that we have a treasure trove of emails suggesting at least that one of Christie's four or five assistant deputy chief of staffs had given the green light for this whole thing. And in a late-night follow-up on Friday night with Politico, and hopefully somebody will send this over to Morning Joe, the governor's office added, quote, just to clear up any lingering confusion, Governor Christie has said each time he has been asked that he first learned about the closing of the lanes on the George Washington Bridge from press accounts after the instance was over. I think the Christie administration is so confused about what lie they're getting caught on that they now have just made it very clear that if David Wildstein can prove his assertion that the governor lied at the press conference, and then, of course, the next question is, why? There could have been children listening. In fact, my daughter said to me the other night, I can't remember if it was Friday night or what, because she's now wanting updates on the Christie thing. She said to me, it's true. And I didn't, and for the sake of her not being branded as a David Wildsteinite, I didn't directly attribute who that quote was made about when I tweeted this out the other night, but she said to me, and I think this is pretty close to a direct quote, it's going to be so awkward if the governor has to go to jail. Meanwhile, yesterday.
It's a simple way to put it.
Yes, it would be awkward.
Cuts to the heart of it.
It would be awkward. Well, Myla is.
Can we actually set up something where if Chris Christie goes to jail. And
we'll get our
will.
Analysis.
Can we get my I want to actually set up something up where we go watching him go into prison and we have Myla there and we just film her saying awkward.
Awkward. The AP reports as of yesterday that Christina Genovese Renna left the governor's office on Friday and essentially resigned. She was directly reported to Deputy Chief of Staff Bridget Kelly. She is also one of 17 people to be subpoenaed by the legislative panel. We don't know if she's being subpoenaed by the DOJ, but my guess is yes. So one more member of the Christie administration has left. Can't imagine why. Meanwhile, as of Friday, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's former campaign manager will plead the Fifth Amendment when he's asked about his role in the apparent plot to create a traffic jam in Fort Lee, New Jersey. This is according to a filing from his lawyer. Bill Stepien was one of the two people disciplined for his actions related to the lane access closures in that two-hour press conference, where if David Wildstein has the proof, it is quite clear that Chris Christie lied at least about one thing. Meanwhile, getting back to that sort of non sequitur paragraph that David Wildstein's lawyer wrote to the Port Authority about there being all of these stories about the Port Authority basically being used as a slush fund for real estate development. Josh Idelson has a piece up today. Why a last-minute revision to the Sandy Project's press release? A promise that a portion of the units will be available, that's end quote, to Sandy-affected seniors was removed from a press release announcing a newly controversial Belleville, New Jersey senior project, a county official confirmed to Salon. A prior version of the May 29 project press release, still posted on the developer's website, stated that, as an added benefit, a portion of the units will be available to assist senior citizens affected by Hurricane Sandy. Which would be no surprise, since millions of dollars for the funding of that project came from Sandy Hurricane Relief Funds. In the final version posted on the website of Essex County, that sentence has been replaced with a different one. Since the project is located in one of the nine counties most impacted by Sandy, the project may assist senior citizens affected by the storm. It's almost as if you want to sort of say, well, no, this was never seen as Sandy projects, and money's fungible-ish. And, of course, the company that was doing all the underwriting is gone, and no one has any records, it seems, as to who got what under what auspices. So why would you think that this was Sandy money? You'll recall that a January 28th Star Ledger story, the paper wrote that Christie, quote, helped channel $6 million in federal Hurricane Sandy recovery dollars to building the senior center, even though the town was not particularly hard hit. Moving on, a new story out of the New Brunswick paper, quoting an NBC story from late Thursday night, early Friday. Governor Chris Christie appropriated $4.8 million in Hurricane Sandy reliefs to help build a luxury high-rise building in New Brunswick. The building, to be named Somerset Mews, already received a city tax abatement and was approved by the city's planning board 8 months before Sandy struck. Its city-based developer, Burai Development LLC, has strong political ties to the governor and Senator Cory Booker.
Surprise, surprise.
And just in case you guys are skeptical about how this is much-needed relief for Sandy, you recall that Hoboken, 80% underwater, got several hundred thousand dollars. New Brunswick was listed as the 188th hardest hit town by Hurricane Sandy in a Rutgers University survey. 188 other towns.
Let's keep it that way. Keep
That's
it low
right.
on the list. Make sure it doesn't all of a sudden get that late tailwind, that Sandy
right.
post.
That way, everyone can run up to the higher floors. Meanwhile, people are pushing back now on the notion of Chris Christie as some type of mean guy. I'm surprised we didn't hear this story earlier, because this is really, really exculpatory as to that charge. The Washington Post did some real digging here, ladies and gentlemen. And apparently back in 1980, when Chris Christie was a mediocre catcher on the Livingston High School baseball team, word got out that a new kid, a guy named Marty Ritt, in the middle of the year was going to be transferring to Livingston High School. He was a baseball player. His position? Catcher. And worse than that?
He was good.
And as told by Scott Parsons, a star pitcher on the team, Scott Parsons was invited over to the Christie home to consult with Chris Christie about what his next move should be. Quote, Parsons says, the family was considering consulting attorneys to see if this could be blocked. He told me if that happened, there was a chance that the whole team would have to forfeit the spring season, and he asked me what my thoughts were. In that instance, writes the Washington Post, Chris Christie passed up the chance to play legal hardball. Todd Christie, Chris Christie's brother, said his father, Bill Christie, had the idea of trying to block Ritt's transfer legally. He said Chris Christie thought his dad was wrong, given the apparent risks that the season might be forfeited and the team and the town might be turned against their family. So, in other words, the Washington Post writes a five-page article arguing that Chris Christie's a good guy because he didn't want to sue to prevent this kid from transferring into his school so that he could play the starting role of catcher. Because he didn't want this kid and his family to go through the tumult of not being able to go to a school near their neighborhood, which they were moving in. No, wait a second. No, I'm sorry. That's not why. He did it because it may come back on him that the season would be canceled and the town might turn against him and his family. What a big heart. Chris Christie was able to make a really self-serving calculus even back in high school, so he must not be a jerk today.
Other kids might have been much more impulsive and stupid, but he wasn't.
No.
That's a good person.
And as a trade-off, he was named team captain.
Oh, my God.
So that he could put it on his resume.
Oh, my God. That is funny.
And that must be, ladies and gentlemen, why, even though he was snubbed last year, Chris Christie has been reinvited to CPAC 2014. And, you know, when Josh Orton came on the program a couple of weeks ago to talk about what he thought Christie needed to do next, we are now seeing Christie do that. Part of that memo that he sent in response to the allegations by David Wildstein's lawyer was to attack the New York Times. So now their response has been to attack MSNBC, to attack the liberal bias in the New York Times, and to head to CPAC. What percentage of his speech at CPAC do you think will be about how the liberal media has completely gone off the rails? They will do anything to attack true conservatives. They have a problem with development that would bring money to developers, but also to ordinary New Jerseyites.
And I didn't sue to stay on the baseball team, so I'll stack my integrity against anyone's.
I'm the type of guy who would never sue to keep a better catcher out of my baseball team if I thought that the rest of the town would get mad at me for doing it. And then the season would be forfeited and I wouldn't be able to play anyways because I was going to graduate this year. I would never do that. That's the type of guy I am. stronger than the storm. So is my family. I don't know if you saw that ad. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Elijah Zarlin of Credo on the latest developments on Keystone XL. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Elijah Zarlin. He is the senior campaign manager for Credo. Welcome to the program, Elijah.
Thanks a lot. Great to be here.
So, all right. On Friday afternoon, the long-awaited final draft of the State Department's EIS, that's their environmental impact study, report was issued. Just give us some backstory on this report and on their earlier drafts.
Right. So the first thing that's important to know about this report is that it was written by an oil industry contractor that was almost literally picked by TransCanada and who went to great lengths to hide their past ties to TransCanada. They worked for TransCanada. And so that's the first thing to know. That's the lens we need to view this report through.
And TransCanada, of course, is the company that's looking to extract this tar sands bitumen from the tar sands in Alberta, and hopefully to ship it through specially constructed pipes that have to keep it warm because this stuff is so corrosive and congealing, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. It's real toxic stuff. The spills are much worse than the spills of the diluted bitumen are much worse than oil than regular oil spills, and it have been really difficult to clean up. So they released their final. This is an update to a draft report that they had released about 9 months ago. The draft, just flying in the face of common sense and all of the analysis and facts, and evidence about what the pipeline's going to do, their draft found that there would be no significant impact to the climate from this pipeline. So most significant in this final, this update, was that they did not say that. And rather, they found that it would have a climate impact. They gave a range of scenarios, but in the worst-case scenario, they said they would have the climate impact of putting, almost 6 million cars on the road. Now, this analysis is still deeply flawed. Doesn't even really come close to identifying the true impact of the pipeline. But looking at it through the lens of having been written by the oil industry, by TransCanada's handpicked contractor, that's kind of a huge grudging assertion that they really even couldn't deny the fact that this pipeline does have a major impact on the climate.
Now, Elijah, it wasn't just Credo, it wasn't just 350.org or the Rainforest Action Committee or other environmentalists around the country who had responded to that earlier draft with skepticism. It was also, my understanding, the EPA saying essentially, you guys don't really seem to
Absolutely.
Know what you're doing. Is that right?
That's exactly right. They raised major concerns. They gave it the grade that they gave it was identifying that it needed some significant updates in the analysis. you know, and now we'll see, because now that this analysis has come out, the State Department enters its national interest determination process, you know, where Secretary Kerry is a little more in charge of that. They're going to get feedback from other agencies. And so we'll see what, you know, what the EPA, who raised major concerns, what they have to say, what the Department of Interior, who raised concerns, we'll see what they have to say. And then, you know, ultimately in hopefully about 3 months' time, Kerry will issue a recommendation to the president, determining whether or not this is in the national interest. And then it's in the president's hands, and he gets to have the final say, yay or nay.
Okay, so now there's two aspects of, in terms of the timelines. We know there's no hard and fast timeline for Secretary of State Kerry to make his determination. Is there a timeline, a specific timeline for those reports from the other administrative offices, like you say, the EPA, Department of the Interior? And also, my understanding is that we're also waiting on an investigator general of the State Department to issue a report on the implications of having someone who works for who has clear conflict of interest, it seems to me, in providing this analysis, that being that company that works for TransCanada. So do we know when those reports are coming in? When are those reports coming in? Do we have a sense? Is there hard and fast dates for these or what?
It was hard to know based on what the State Department said last week, exactly when that Inspector General report's going to come out. Some folks were saying Tuesday, but the State Department themselves, the Inspector General's office, wasn't committing to a date. And that's a whole other wrinkle here, is that the Inspector General launched this investigation into conflict of interest with, you know, the contractor writing the report, and yet they released the report, the environmental analysis, before the conflict of interest, you know, allegations have even been determined. So that could add an entire new wrinkle if they find, you know, that the State Department's guidelines for conflict of interest weren't followed. So that could add an entire, you know, more delays or who knows. But as it stands now, you know, the agencies have 90 days to weigh in.
Okay.
And then, you know, as you say, Kerry makes his recommendation, which he doesn't have a timeline for, and then the president makes the final call, which, again, there is no specific deadline.
I'm fascinated by the fact that this investigative general report is going to come out after this report. I mean,
it doesn't make a lot of sense.
It doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, I guess if it comes out saying all clear, you still have this sort of weird notion that they went forward without it. And I guess it has less implications. I mean, I'm not sure I buy it, but I guess I'll wait to see what that report says if that's what it comes out in. But if it comes out saying that, yeah, there's a real problem here, because it should be fairly obvious that if a company is getting paid significantly by a company they hope to do more business with in the future, rather than this one-off for the State Department, they may actually taint their perspective on this in some way. That just seems stunning, but I guess maybe, who knows? It's just a very weird way of going about doing it. So we've got 30 days to hear from the other agencies. Putting that aside, what is I've talked to I think to both you and to Becky Bond from Credo in the past, and I'm as well as Bill McKibben from 350.org, and there has been for over a year now pledges by upwards of 50,000 people, correct me if I'm wrong, that they will get involved in some type of civil disobedience following this report. Or when exactly, what's the timing of that, and what's happening today?
So the timing of the pledge is, as you say, over 75,000 people have pledged to risk arrest, you know, in peaceful and dignified civil disobedience if necessary to stop approval of Keystone XL. The trigger for that action would be the National Interest Determination Report, so the thing that's going to come out after the agencies have their 90 days to submit feedback, and specifically a report, you know, only if Secretary Kerry says to the president, you know, this thing, we recommend that you approve this thing, we think it's in the national interest. That would trigger, you know, a massive wave of civil disobedience. you know, we're optimistic now that this is a little bit more in Kerry's hands, out of the hands of, you know, the oil industry in a process that's obviously so easy for them to corrupt. You know, that the Secretary of State, who is clearly wants to be a climate leader and, you know, has been a climate leader in the past, but he's not going to let that happen. And so, you know, we're hopeful that, you know, all of these people, making this commitment, is going to help swing the president, you know, and the administration. And we're going to see a lot of that, later today. So what's happening today is that, folks across the country, just over the weekend, have organized nationwide vigils to protest the pipeline. So since Friday afternoon when the report came out, we put out the call for folks to organize in their own community and put up vigils. And I'm just looking right now because the numbers just keep going up. It's really astonishing. But since Friday afternoon, activists across the country have planned 263 vigils in 47 or 48 states plus Washington, D.C., and there's almost 7,000 people that are going to be out there. And this is, again, something that's just been put together since Friday afternoon.
Wow.
So it's really an astonishing show of just, you know, how fiercely people oppose this project and how much they're willing to really get out there and organize, and send the message to the president.
And it's also an indication. So how many people is that total now? I mean, that are getting involved in these vigils over the next two nights?
Oh, just the vigils today?
Yeah.
There's you know, the numbers just keep going up, but there's 7,000 people that have already RSVP'd.
Wow.
And I think by this evening we'll be closer to 10,000 people around the country coming out, you know, at over 250 events.
Wow. And so where can people get more information on that and participate if they're so inclined?
So the good short link is bit.ly/noKXLvigil.
Okay. We will find that link. We'll put it on the front page at majority.fm, for people
Fantastic.
Who are not good with the bit.ly, links,
yeah.
But, and so
yeah,
that's happening tonight. And then, so what?
That's happening tonight around 6 PM local time. And there, you know, almost in every big city across the country.
And so what happens now between tonight and presumably 90 days plus?
Well, you know, I think we're going to see a lot more activism from people as, you know, as we kind of head into this final stage. The State Department is opening up another public comment period for 30 days to take public comments, you know, on the environmental analysis they just released. I think we're going to see a lot of folks commenting on urging the administration to reject it. I think it's just going to build from there. And I think we're going to see, you know, more and more people as, you know, I mean, as, you know, the effects of climate change just become worse and worse, literally, you know, by the day around the country. I think we're going to see people just doing whatever they can to escalate that message to the president. And, you know, it's really astonishing and moving the degree to which people have been willing to get out there and send the message.
Yeah.
And I hope the president's watching. I think he is.
It's pretty fantastic. I mean, to get like 7,000 or 10,000 people, over the course of literally just 2 or 3 days on a Friday news dump that was actually in many respects sort of shrouded by the Christie, news in the Super Bowl. I think that's pretty indicative of how serious those 75,000 people who have made that pledge are. Elijah Zarlin, senior campaign manager from Credo, thank you so much for your time today, and keep up the good work.
Thanks a lot, Sam. Talk to you later.
All right, folks. We're going to take a break. We will go into the funner half of the program, wherein I will read an email that I received. It's not a personal email from Peter Schiff. It's one that he sent out to all his listeners or people who signed up on their email list. I'm one of those people. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about the right-wing response to the Coke soda ad. Also, this story in the Times, you know, it reminds me of a story that we had a couple of years ago from marketing agencies who were saying, you know, no more ads for like banal consumer goods because that market's drying up. You know, we are talking luxury items. I was struck by the ads on the Super Bowl last night. They all seem to be of like a lot of car ads. That bailout seems to have worked, or I should say that loan seems to have worked. But a lot of luxury cars.
There's a Maserati commercial. That was weird.
I mean, it's pretty stunning. There was not a lot of ads. Now, granted, Super Bowl, prime real estate. But you just don't see a lot of ads for, like, you know, dishwashing liquid. You know, banal sort of everyday products. There's just no money in there for those companies now. It's either a big ticket item or and this piece in the Times sort of outlines that. You know, it's either Hermes or Barney's or the dollar outlet is really the only things that are doing well these days. So we will talk about that. We'll talk about the Peter Schiff. There's De Blasio is talking about taking some money for, earmarked for charter schools. Millions of dollars gone to charter schools under the Bloomberg administration, just sucking resources out of the public school system. We will discuss that. We will probably do a random rush. Maybe we'll play the sound from Dinesh D'Souza, who you'll recall Dinesh D'Souza, I think we reported the other day, is looking at some federal campaign finance law violations. He illegally, allegedly, gave money to people to give to a candidate. Of course, we know why he did that, because Obama made him do it. There's multiple means in which apparently Obama has to do that, but we will talk about those.
Do I really need to send the black Muslim assassin Benghazi squad to your house? I don't want to have to do it.
Well, it's not just that.
Let's do some illegal bundles.
We'll get into the stuff where...
He went to Kenya? What?
Sends messages. Folks, your support makes this show possible. Please become a member today. Majority.fm, become a member. It is your support that keeps this show going on a daily basis. And hopefully, if by some strange miracle... 150, like 500 of you look in the mirror and go, hey, I should become a member today. Then you'll also see a significant bump in quality of this program. It'll take a week or two, but you can also support this program by going to majorityreportkickback.com, wherein you can click, if you buy crap through Amazon, you must buy it through our link. There is no excuse. Super easy to do now. MajorityReportKickback.com. You click on the Amazon link. You bookmark it. Always buy your Amazon junk through there. I don't know what's that. I don't know. Is that the 360?
That is the 360.
We got to get a new cable or something for that. So MajorityReportKickback.com. Also, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Give us a review on iTunes. Get the app, MajorityApp.com. All right, we'll be back in just a moment. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at Majority FM. See you in a second.